You're listening to the WFYI Weekly News Podcast for the week of Monday, January 11th, 2016. I'm Christopher Ayers. This week, Indiana's first publicly commissioned mural was completed in the 1970s. Now it's the centerpiece of a public exhibition.
Make it a part of this whole re-recognition of the importance of public civic space.
From State Impact Indiana, the latest installment of a series following three new teachers through their first year on the job.
When you're a first-year teacher, you've got your doubts. Am I doing this the right way? How can I be doing this better?
And a conversation with Bob Boylan, the host of All Songs Considered. Those stories and more are coming up. Please stay tuned. But first this week, Governor Mike Pence delivered his annual State of the State address on Tuesday.
Speaker Bosma, President Pro Tem Long, Lieutenant Governor Elsterman, Senator Lannan, Representative Pilath, Senator Coates, members of the Indiana General Assembly, distinguished guests, my fellow Hoosiers.
And he discussed a lot of things, things he's proud of. The state's unemployment rate at more than 8% when he took office now sits below the national rate at around 4.4%. The state's labor force is now the largest in the state's history, approaching 3.3 million workers. He talked about other things Indiana could do better, like combating the persistent scourge of drug addiction that's plagued so many Hoosiers, as well as the families of addicts who have to deal with the tragic fallout when addiction so often prevails. But many Hoosiers were waiting for one moment, and it didn't come until about 20 minutes into the governor's speech.
Jobs, the economy, schools, roads, and confronting drug abuse. These are my priorities. But I'm aware there's at least one more issue getting attention in this session of the General Assembly. Namely, whether to extend full civil rights protections to Hoosiers on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity.
You may recall a bill that passed last year and was signed into law by the governor in March, the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, or RFRA. Supporters claim it's a measure designed to simply shore up gaps between religious liberty protections guaranteed by the First Amendment. They say it gives courts a set of guidelines within which to work when hearing cases that involve alleged infringement of religious beliefs. Opponents, on the other hand, argued the bill was designed to allow religiously conservative business owners the ability to deny services to lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender Hoosiers. For example, they claim a bakery owner could potentially refuse to bake a cake for a same-sex wedding by claiming the action would violate a deeply held religious belief, and then use RFRA as a defense if the case went to court. The bill sailed pretty much under the radar most of the session, until the governor signed it into law during a private ceremony. Then it blew up. A national uproar ensued. Boycott threats from businesses to celebrities, even several states, came pouring in. For an entire week, national media outlets set up shop outside the State House. Governor Pence defended the bill. He went on national TV to do so. But after pressure from influential business interests, the mayor of Indianapolis, a fellow Republican, and others, he eventually signed a bill meant to clarify the original measure. It said, in short, that RFRA could not be used to discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. But it didn't go as far as some wanted, an amendment to the state civil rights law that would extend full protections to LGBT Hoosiers, something supporters said they'd fight for when the next session began in 2016. Now, Governor Pence has said he's carefully studied the issue, and up until Tuesday, he'd kept his cards held tightly to his chest. And when he got to the topic in his speech, he said he'd consider any bill the legislature sent him, with one condition.
I will not support any bill that diminishes the religious freedom of Hoosiers or interferes with the constitutional rights of our citizens to live out their beliefs in worship, service, or work.
So, what exactly that means for the prospects of this issue being settled this session, at this point, is anyone's guess. But on Thursday, House Speaker Brian Bosma told the Indianapolis Star that the governor's position probably made it difficult to grant an extension of civil rights protections. Two bills are currently awaiting committee debate in the state Senate. So as the General Assembly goes about its business this session, the issue is sure to stick around. All we can say right now, then, is stay tuned. Now, as we mentioned in the first segment, drug addiction is a growing problem in the state of Indiana. And although its place in the headlines of late has been usurped by the state's ongoing heroin and prescription opioid epidemics, Indiana's methamphetamine problem isn't going away. As 90.1 WFYI's Lee DeNoon reports, while the police are doing what they can to suppress meth, legislators are considering ways to further inhibit production of the extremely addictive drug.
What looked like a male passenger just got back in. They're backing out now.
All right, I'm clear. If they go into Kroger, I would like you to tail them if you could, please.
From his car outside a pharmacy in Monticello, Trooper Wesley Ennis was tracking a man he suspected was trying to buy what he needed to make meth, including the most important ingredient, pseudoephedrine. As he listened to his police radio, Ennis monitored a laptop where he can watch real-time Sudafed sales for every pharmacy in the state, and he kept an eye on approaching traffic.
Yeah, they're following the car in there and just right over
here. We got a long eye. We're southbound now, but we're several vehicles back.
Indiana police made more than 1,500 meth lab busts last year, nearly 100 more than in 2014. The term meth lab conjures up images of rural homes and trailers or a scene from Breaking Bad. But these days, most meth makers use what police call the one-pot method. It's basically a plastic bottle with ingredients easily found in pharmacies and hardware stores. These explosive cocktails are so easily concealed that Ennis says police even busted a walking meth lab in Lafayette.
As they're talking with him, one of the officers who has been to several meth labs recognized that chemical odor that is recognized as a one-pot meth lab. And sure enough, this guy had a live one-pot in a backpack that he was carrying. So here we are downtown Lafayette, and he's manufacturing meth basically as he's walking down the street.
While crystal meth, imported mainly from Mexico, is made in large labs using complex chemistry, home-cooked methamphetamine ingredients are simple and include the crucial pseudoephedrine. That's why Senate Bill 80 would require Hoosier pharmacists to decide if someone is eligible to purchase Sudafed over-the-counter. While the Indiana State Police won't take a stand on pending legislation, Sergeant Mike Tolles, acting commander of the Meth Suppression Unit, says he'd personally like to see pseudoephedrine become a prescription drug.
The argument is, well, pseudoephedrine is a very effective nasal decongestant, and I agree it is. But there's also over 100 other, actually probably over 130 other medications out there that you can get going to your pharmacy that don't require a prescription that address that.
Tolles is a veteran in the meth suppression unit, and he's frustrated that despite law enforcement's best efforts, they haven't made more headway on a problem that too often involves innocent victims, kids. For him, it's a family health problem, a public health problem.
We're not just dealing with the user and the seller. We're dealing with the environments. We're dealing with children. You look at the numbers of children, we're going to be over 300 children this year identified at labs. And I hate to use this comparison, but sometimes it makes people think, if a dog were locked inside a home where they were manufacturing meth and the dog became ill or died because of it, people would be writing editorials. They would be outraged. Where's the outrage?
Tolles supervises meth investigators assigned in each of Indiana's 13 state police districts, like Trooper Ennis working the bust in Monticello. After undercover officers followed the suspect home, uniformed troopers helped arrest him.
For possession of precursors. So he's a meth offender again that had purchased Sudafed after being convicted of manufacturing meth. So we were able to obtain a warrant for his arrest, and that's what got us in the house.
Lawmakers this session are considering whether to deny Sudafed for all felony drug offenders, not just those with meth convictions. For 90.1 WFYI News, I'm Lee DeNoon, Indianapolis.
Continuing our coverage of education issues across the state, State Impact Indiana's Claire McInerney is following three new teachers throughout each his first year in the classroom. In this installment of a series we're calling The First Year, she recently caught up with two of them to see how they use the winter break to reflect on the first semester and prepare for their second.
Will you show me any of the Christmas presents you got?
I met second grade teacher Sarah Draper at her house over break.
Oh, yeah. One brought me a whole box of cookies that we did eat.
We're looking at the presents some of her students gave her. Cookies, candles, ornaments.
So it is like a little ball, a little ornament ball that's hand-painted red. And it has S and D for Sarah Draper, I think. I'm pretty sure that's Sarah Draper. And 2G for second grade.
Sarah teaches second grade at Helmsburg Elementary in Brown County. She's been using her break to work on the house and put together bags for donation. Instead of waking up at 5:30, she's been sleeping in until 9:30.
I haven't slept till 9:30 since, I don't know, like high school or like beginning of college.
She's also been planning things for this next semester.
I'm really excited to kind of establish different routines.
Like lining up quietly on the way to the lunchroom.
And like the last week of school, they were kind of crazy. And I felt like our routines were just horrible. Like we'd try like lining up quietly. We'd have to do it like 8 times before like it would actually happen. And then... So I'm excited just to, like, go over the routines again, go over the procedures, and have that, like, fresh start.
I have all those boxes up on top of my cabinet.
In Indianapolis, first-year teacher Gabe Hoffman also used his winter break to reflect.
Like, so I can have whatever on there. Mm-hmm. But then, like, I have all this.
We're in his third-grade classroom at Nora Elementary, and he's pointing at posters on the wall.
Most of this stuff is old.
Yeah.
So I can take a lot of it down and probably just... keep stuff up in one section.
The fire marshal said he has to cut displays back to 20% of his space. He's reorganizing other things as well.
So I took a lot of the stuff out of the desk and just threw a lot of stuff away that I really didn't need. And I got my area a little bit more organized, which was a relief.
Gabe says he wasn't prepared for how much this job would consume him. During the semester, he spends around 12 hours a day working for his students. And after that, his friend circle is mostly other teachers. So they talk shop even when they aren't working.
Because when you're a first-year teacher, you've got your doubts. You've got, am I doing this the right way? How can I be doing this better? You know, you spend a lot of time talking to other teachers and getting suggestions. And a lot of times in education, everybody has a different suggestion. And different people want you to do things different ways. So trying to figure out, okay, take pieces of what you hear from this person and mesh it with your own style.
I asked him to give me the high and low from this semester. His high? He made a breakthrough with a student who was giving up really easily. And through tantrums when things didn't go his way. Gabe says this child now has a positive attitude in class and is even a leader and participates during lessons. But the low for Gabe was a math lesson.
And I tried for 45 minutes, like every different way I could think of teaching it. I tried pictures. I tried standing the kids up and moving them to divide it. I tried...
None of these tactics worked, though.
So I left that day thinking, like, I failed the kids today. I didn't know. I ran out of ideas. I should have more ways to present this. I should have had some other way that they could get it. This was on me, not them. Because I only had, to me, seeing that only one or two kids gets it, that's my fault.
I asked him to summarize the semester in 6 words.
Teaching is very difficult, but rewarding.
Yeah, I know. It's just funny that you put it on.
Back at Sarah's, I asked her for 6 words as well.
Am I doing the right thing?
By this, she doesn't mean is teaching the right thing. She means...
I just don't know, like, if I'm doing it right or, like, should I... Like, if I've been teaching for 20 years and I still do, like, would I let them do that? Should I let them do that?
Like asking to go to the nurse when nothing seems wrong or wanting to take a book to recess. And Sarah says her biggest lesson from this first semester is that making mistakes is an essential part of her own learning process.
I think it's hard because you see veteran teachers who don't seem to put as much time in. They've already put their time in.
And she looks at the new semester as a fresh start. For State Impact Indiana, I'm Claire McInerney.
Indianapolis's first publicly commissioned mural was completed over 40 years ago through a program called Urban Walls. Now the piece, which has seen better days, is at the center of an exhibition that's exploring public art in Indy during the 1970s. 90.1 WFYI's Jill Sheridan has the story.
When it was created in 1973, the four-story mural made quite a splash at the corner of Delaware and Court in downtown Indianapolis. But today it doesn't make much of an impression for people like Susan Bentley.
I work right there. I walk here almost every day, and no, I've never noticed it.
Time has not been kind to the untitled mural. Its radiant scarlet red, tangerine, and bright blue hues have faded to burnt orange, mustard yellow, gray, and dirty white. The swooping geometric arcs composed of triangles and rectangles seem tired somehow. Huge chips mar its surface, and half of it's been painted over because of water damage. 42 years ago, the piece was part of an effort to revitalize the downtown core and help create Indy's public art identity. And Roland Hobart was the man behind the mural. Hobart had a stroke in 2013, and he's in an assisted living facility now in Bloomington. But in the late 60s, the Austrian-born artist who came to Indiana made an impression on the city's art scene. He created prints for Indy's sesquicentennial. He won the mural commission in 1973 and says the blank canvas of buildings right across from the city-county building, one of the city's only skyscrapers at the time, inspired him.
I looked at the architecture. I start with one shape and then add to it. It's like doing a painting. You don't see it when it's finished.
Richard McCoy, art consultant and director at Landmark Columbus, became friends with Hobart a few years ago while researching the mural that has become a sort of passion project for him. The two talk about what the piece meant at the time.
Tension, harmony, you can express this in colors.
So is your mural intention, or is it happy?
It's all happy, yeah.
Is it you?
Yeah, it's my environment.
Today, Indy boasts nearly 100 murals, 46 of them created when the Super Bowl came to town. Hobart thinks that a restored wall may resonate even more in 2016 than it did in 1973.
I think today they probably would appreciate it more than at the time. People are more cultural.
As we drive back from Bloomington to Indy, the modern city skyline comes into view. McCoy says he sees a lot of parallels between the downtown Indy of the early 70s and today.
It's because we're in that same mode with downtown. We're thinking about downtown. We want to be positive. We want to be progressive. We want to be in the future. And so the message is still there.
So what if the city's first mural could be part of that future and not just some faded remnant of the past? Julia Mooney Moore thinks it's the right place for that. In the heart of a $350 million redevelopment, what's now called the Market East District downtown. Moore is director of public art for the Indianapolis Arts Council and says she'd like to see a restoration of the urban wall.
Make it a part of this whole, I don't want to say a renaissance of public spaces because it never really went away, but the re-recognition of the importance of public civic space.
McCoy is curating an exhibition, Public Art in Indianapolis, 1960s through early 2000s, that starts January 19th at UIndy, showcasing Hobart's work and exploring other modern era projects. The school is also hosting a symposium on the topic of public art in February. For 90.1 WFYI News, I'm Jill Sheridan.
Finally this week, you might know him as the host of All Songs Considered from NPR, or as the host of the popular Tiny Desk concert series, but Bob Boylan has a lot more up his sleeve for 2016. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Tom Maloney talked with Bob about a new book he's written and the second annual Tiny Desk Contest.
Bob, you've had quite the musical journey. It's now being cataloged in your new book, Your Song Changed My Life. What's the book about? Can I buy it yet? Can you just send me an advanced copy?
We can do all those things. You can buy it and I can send you an advanced copy. But the book is a journey trying to discover the inspiration behind an artist. So what the book does, I interview 35 musicians about a song that changed their life. And I take that interview, I take the song they chose, I look at their music, I look at the music that they chose, and try to draw connections between those things. And it's really, really interesting how fate often comes into play to change in a person's life. I found it fascinating, you know, having listened to people like Jimmy Page most of my life, and to find that if it weren't for some kid at school who was playing a Lonnie Donegan song, and the fact that when his family moved into a house, there was a guitar in the closet, we might not have had Led Zeppelin, you know. I find those things quite remarkable.
I hope you've included a song that's changed your life.
I picked a Beatles song because I grew up in that age, and the song A Day in the Life is a song that changed me. It was a piece of music unlike any other piece of music at the time.
I read the news today, oh boy, about a lucky man who made the grade. And though the news was rather sad,
it was a time where you saw a band like the Beatles play I Want to Hold Your Hand in 1964, and only 3 years later with a, you know, 60-plus piece orchestra, backward tape loops, all sorts of songs that really, there were many songs inside one song. That song was about, you know, both the horrible death of somebody in a car crash, but also about the mediocrity in life and the everyday boredom of getting up and running a comb through your hair and rushing to work.
Woke up, fell out of bed, dragged a comb across my head. Found the way downstairs and drank a cup.
It's quite the song, and it was unlike anything else, and it really did change the way I thought about what music was.
You've got a desk, and at that desk, some of the most famous musicians in the world come and play right in front of you. Where did the idea for the Tiny Desk Concert come from?
I was at South by Southwest with another NPR music team member, Stephen Thompson, and Stephen and I went to see this singer, bit of a quirky singer, Laura Gibson. She's an acquired taste, let's just say, but both Stephen and I love Laura. Went to see her. It was a noisy bar. I could hardly hear Laura. She's very, very quiet. And when she came off stage, Stephen and I introduced ourselves, and Stephen jokingly said, well, we couldn't hear you, but you ought to come play our office. She took us up on it, and I got a couple of cameras out, got a microphone. She called up. She was on tour with the Decemberists. She said, I'm coming. She showed up, and we recorded it. And the reaction to that video that I edited and put out was remarkable.
Up with the sunrise, you'll be staring out through the window on the day. I'll be enough.
What was it that was so remarkable?
There's something magic and something we don't get enough of. People don't often hear music that is not highly produced or has a wall of something, be it lights, smoke, or reverb, or whatever, between them and the voice. And I think that's why I loved it, why people loved it.
That's a fascinating story, not one that I think I could have ever imagined being the start of something so big in the music world. Now, let's talk about the Tiny Desk Contest, Bob. This brewed out of the Tiny Desk Concert last year. First question for this one, did you not already have enough music to listen to?
Touche.
All right, so Fantastic Negrito comes on really out of the 7,000 plus entries from last year. He ends up with the number one blues album on the Billboard Blues charts. Did you expect that kind of outpouring of support for the winner, to have them be able to hit number one in whatever musical genre it was, to be able to go ahead and have all those TV appearances and the like?
I think the best is yet to come for that guy, but you can't not see him and know that he is destined for something bigger. He is, which is why he won. He was undeniable.
Lost in a crowd, you feel your doubts out loud.
And that's sort of what we're looking for when we're looking for what we think of as the winner. Someone that you just look at and say, wow, they really have something. And you don't have to love what they have. That's not the point, but you know that they have something unique to themselves. And that's what we look for not just the winners, but I think all musicians should strive for. They should try to do something that only they could do, that is their own thing. Because when you think about the music you love, Tom, and the music I love, that's usually what it's all about. It's somebody who has a unique voice. And I don't just mean voice in the terms of what comes out of your mouth, but in your vibe, in the way you approach things, the way you say things, and the way you play that guitar or the synthesizer or the talking drum or whatever it might be.
Bob, what are you expecting going into the second annual Tiny Desk Contest? A lot more than 7,000 entries, I assume?
Yeah, my guess is we'll probably get more than 10,000. It's one thing to look for and find a winner, and that'll be a wonderful thing. And I expect to find an artist that, you know, raises the hair on the back of my neck and makes me very happy. But the other part of this, for the 9,999 that might not win, but they participate, the communities that form around those bands that form, or the community that forms between the solo guitar singer-songwriter person and the person who edits and records the video or whatever, all these things get made and probably wouldn't have gotten made had it not been for the contest. And that's the thing that I love the most. I love being challenged to do something in my own personal life. Every year I make an album in the month of February because there's this thing called the RPM Challenge. And it just says, make a record between February 1st and February 28th. And I do. And I wouldn't make it if it wasn't for that. And I've made things that I'm quite proud of. And that's what I want to have happen here. I want people to make things they're proud of. It's not about winning, although winning is a fantastic and wonderful thing. There are many bands who didn't win the contest who have come and played my desk because I heard them.
When does Bob Boylan play the Tiny Desk Concert?
I like that. I hadn't thought of that yet, Tom.
Thank you so much for your time, Bob. And for those of you wondering how to get your entry into the second annual Tiny Desk Contest, head over to tinydeskcontest.npr.org and submit your entry before February 2nd. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Tom Maloney.
That's it for this edition of the WFYI Weekly News Podcast. You can follow us online at WFYI.org, on Twitter at WFYI News, and on Facebook, WFYI. You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. You can stream it on the web at SoundCloud. Just search WFYI. This has been a production of WFYI News, produced at 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Studios in Indianapolis. I'm Christopher Ayers. Thanks for listening.